Now, from what's happening now to what happened then, he is a very important fellow and an all-around smart guy. He's Lawrence Reed. Hi, Lawrence.
Hey, good morning, Mandy. How are you?
I'm pleased as punch to have you back on the show. Since we last spoke, when you were the director, president, El Presidente at the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, you've now moved on. You're with the Foundation for Economic Education.
That's right. I still retain a connection to the Mackinac Center as a president emeritus, but my full-time job is president of FEE, Foundation for Economic Education. That's right.
And then you do a little moonlighting for the Heritage Foundation.
Yes, I do.
So
all three groups.
You're a smart guy, and I need smarts right about now. We just had on a gentleman named Dr. Michael Lissick, and he was talking about the bailouts that are happening now and why they are necessary and things of that nature. But I thought it would be interesting to talk to you because you are an economic historian and give an interesting perspective on what's happening now versus what's happening or what happened, especially in the Great Depression. I got to tell you, Larry, if I hear one more person say, this is the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression, it's driving me nuts because mostly from reading your work, I know that the two things could, though there may feel like similarities, they're really not at all alike, are they?
No, I mean, there are important similarities, but vast differences. And one of the similarities is, of course, that this is largely a government-created crisis. But you should never underestimate the ability of government or politicians to take a bad situation that they created and make it much worse. But what took the early days of the Depression, when it was still a recession, and made it much worse are things that haven't yet happened here, and that includes a massive tax increase, and huge increases in tariffs that close the borders to trade. If our politicians today were to go down that path, as they did in the early 30s, they could make this situation far worse.
And I got to tell you, no fooling Barack Obama and Joe Biden running around talking about raising taxes.
Yeah, that's right. They both are. And there is a lot of protectionist talk as well that would raise American barriers to trade. So there is that talk, and if they do it, then we would be following the path of the 1930s, and we take a bad situation to make it much worse.
Let me ask you this. A guy called in yesterday, and his beef with me is that I'm not a fan of unions, okay? That's his underlying beef with me, but he was making a point that, you know, why aren't we doing something to stem the flow of production and manufacturing overseas? And the point I tried to make to him was, part of the reason that companies do that is because there are oppressive tax structures that exist in the United States and other requirements that we have in the United States that serve as barriers to free trade. Now, what can we do now? Are you in favor of a more open trading policy, or where do you stand on that?
Oh, yes. I think it's always to our benefit to allow people to engage in wider commercial transactions with people of other parts of the world. Take my state here of Michigan, the home of the auto industry. We have the worst economy in the country, and not by coincidence, we also have the most favorable climate for union activism. We have one of the highest rates of unionization in the country, and we have one of the highest tax burdens. And at the same time that our industry, based in Detroit, is having a difficult time competing, you've got foreign automakers who are doing just fine in America, who have opened plants here and or are selling cars here that they've made overseas, and they're doing just fine because they don't have to operate in their countries or in many of our own states under the kind of oppressive labor rules, union militancy, and high taxes. So there's a lot that needs to be done at the state level, but also at the federal level to make America more competitive.
Let me talk about historically the role of unions, because at some point unions were necessary to protect, you know, there were outrageous violations of worker rights. There were no worker rights back in the day. At what point do the unions move from being a productive protection for the American worker to a situation like we have in Michigan where it creates an oppressive work environment that actually stifles the economy?
Well, when unions start to use their government-bestowed powers to compel dues and other exclusive representation and collective bargaining rights to force wage rates above levels of productivity. You know, oftentimes unions will push wage rates up at the same time they're adding expensive work rules so that the end result is lower productivity but at higher cost. When they start doing that, it has the effect of pricing the products that they make out of the marketplace. And they have done that in industry after industry. And, you know, for a time, it looks as though it's kind of working. A lot of people in Michigan thought in the 1950s and 60s that the unions were getting them a pretty good deal. But sometimes the effects of these things take a little time, and now the chickens have come home to roost. And decades of union militancy now is really paying its negative dividends by making American automakers extremely uncompetitive. You know that until just up until a couple of years ago, the automakers in America were spending $1 billion a year just to have workers idle, sitting in buildings, doing nothing all day long. Laid off workers, there was no job for them, but with the union contracts being what they were, the companies were obligated to pay them about 80% of salary. So there's no other automaker in the world that pays out $1 billion a year for workers who produce nothing.
Steve Lawrence Reed, he is with the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, and now with the Foundation for Economic Freedom, he is an all-around smart guy and economic historian. I love talking to you, by the way, Larry. I learned so much talking to you, it's not even funny.
Thank you.
It is, it's great. And now, before the break, we mentioned the fact that the auto industries and unionization and that stuff. What is your take on this bailout of the auto industry?
Well, I think it's terrible news. I just don't think that the American government at this point in time needs to add to its debt burden and to be bailing out firms. And I know there are people who are saying, well, it'll be paid back. But the American people need to understand that in this year alone, and we're only 9 months into it, the U.S. government has assumed an additional $1 trillion in obligations in the form of special loans and bailouts and what have you. And that's on top of a national debt approaching $10 trillion. At some point, we have to say, no more Band-Aids. People are going to have to live up to the obligations that they've made. They're going to have to bear the consequences of their own poor decisions. If we want to help the auto industry, we ought to start not by assuming new debt on their behalf, but instead by relieving them of some of the onerous and ridiculous regulations we've imposed, like the corporate average fuel economy standards. We've been raising that in Washington dramatically over the years, and that's part of the problem. Management's made a lot of bad decisions. The unions have been a part of it, too. But none of those things are reasons for the taxpayers to be on the hook for another $25 billion.
I have to tell you, I just read an article, I guess it was last week, about a new small diesel vehicle that Ford makes. And it gets 60 miles to the gallon. But they're not going to sell it here because of the prohibitive diesel taxes that exist. I mean, diesel is taxed even more heavily than regular gasoline because we have to punish those truckers for all the damage they do to our roads, even as they're moving our goods and services across the country. You know, why aren't we pointing out the fact that it would appear that the auto industries, at least in part, are preventing marketable vehicles that are already being sold in Europe from being sold in this market because of the level of taxation?
Well, this is a problem we face, and in fact, many economists are shaking their head about this all the time. You pick the issue. You have lots of people out there who just refuse to focus on the fundamentals. Instead, they take a crisis of the moment. They want to patch it up with Band-Aids because that's flashy, it sounds good, it sounds activist, I'm going to solve the problem.
I'm going to do something.
Yeah, exactly. But that's much different than the doing the nitty-gritty of actually exploring what put us in this problem in the first place and how are we going to fix that. Instead, we just keep piling debt upon debt, new obligation on new obligation, tax upon tax, program upon program. And, you know, within a few years, there's another crisis and we do another round of the same thing. This can't continue. This is an unsustainable, head-in-the-sand approach. What we've got to do with one problem after another is focus on fixing the fundamentals.
Now, let me ask you this. Our last guest just said, when I suggested that but just from reading some of your writing about the Great Depression, it would appear to me that the government intervention actually really extended the pain of the Great Depression. How do we know that the bailout of AIG is not ultimately going to do the same thing? And he made the argument that, okay, well, if AIG fails, the spiderweb effect would be so damaging that we would have to have 2 weeks of bank holidays. We would not be able to access any. And the repercussions of an AIG failure of a company of that size would be so great that we cannot allow it to happen. How accurate is that? I mean, you do look at AIG and how many tentacles they have wrapped around so many other companies. Is that a fair assessment, or should we just say, let it fail and let the chips fall where they may?
Well, a failure of AIG surely would have been more serious than Lehman Brothers, for example. But at this point, I think you have to bite the bullet. What we've done with this bailout is not really solve the problem. We've just set ourselves up for an even bigger one sometime down the road. And, of course, it'd be nice if we could turn the clock back and undo or never have done all the things that put us in this problem in the first place. I mean, these folks who want to give us ever bigger government all the time set us up for these problems. And then when they happen, of course, their answer is always more government on top of that. Now, having said that, what should we have done with AIG? I think the government probably should have just let it go. It would have been very painful, but an orderly liquidation, even a momentarily disorderly one, is in the long run going to be would be better than assuming this unsustainable debt burden. You have to think of these things in terms of their long-term consequences. What kind of a signal does it send, once again, several times this week, when the government says, well, you're too big to fail in spite of the risky investments you've made, so we're going to put the taxpayers on the hook for your mistakes?
Exactly. And I got to tell you, Larry, I spent all day yesterday trying to delve through this thing and came to the conclusion, I've said it a couple times, if you're going to fail, fail big.
Yeah.
Because if you're a huge failure, if you're the biggest failure out there, the government will then rush to your aid.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, by assuming the burdens of all these large firms, the U.S. government is setting itself up someday to fail. And let me tell you, if the U.S. government fails, you ain't seen, you know, the AIG is nothing compared to what that would produce. And anybody who looks at the balance sheet or the long-term unfunded obligations of the U.S. federal government has to be incredibly alarmed by the passage of yet another week where we've added tens of billions of additional red ink. I mean, that is not sustainable. It's not a viable solution to today's problems to simply say, power on the debt to the taxpayer.
Well, and one of the things that I forgot to ask this gentleman about, which is a valid, very valid concern, someone emailed me, you know, when you look back at the Great Depression and the run on dollars and the shrinking of the amount of money in the system, our dollars at that time were backed by gold. They're backed by nothing now.
Yeah.
And that to me is that something to be, because I'm incredibly concerned about that.
Yeah, the gold exacts a kind of discipline on the monetary authorities. We have no link whatever to a precious metal today, and what that means is we're at the mercy completely of the goodwill of those in charge of the printing press. And while we certainly could have had far worse people at that helm, nonetheless, when they are facing the kind of monumental budget deficits, national debt, and now assuming the obligations of failing firms, they actually are boxed into a situation where over time, they'll have to either pressure the government to raise taxes dramatically or more likely just print more money.
Now, let me ask you this, because I know that there are people in the audience that don't know. Why did we come off the gold standard in the first place? What was the overarching logic that this was going to propel us forward doing this?
Well, I like to put it this way, Mandy, that governments don't like gold because they can't print it. And for most of history, when markets have preferred stable monies like precious metals, governments have tended to fight that. All over the world, governments find their way to assume control over money, and then that usually, in fact, it never results in the money becoming worth more. It only results in it becoming worth less because they progressively dilute the metal content so they can manufacture more of it to pay for all their spending schemes. And in the 1930s, in the midst of crisis, Franklin Roosevelt felt that seizing gold and demonetizing it would make it easier for the federal government to inflate the money supply and thereby assist us in getting out of the Depression. Now, as everybody really ought to know, he tinkered with that and a lot of other stuff for 8 years, and we were still in a Depression. It didn't work. But we've been saddled with that problem ever since, and now the government can print as much as it wants at any time because there's no discipline exacted by the precious metal standard.
Don, you're on Wink News Radio with Lawrence Reed.
Good morning.
Good morning.
A couple of years ago, I read a book called The Creature from Jekyll Island on how the Federal Reserve System come to be.
Yes.
I don't know if you're familiar with that. I'm sure you are.
Yes, I am.
Now, last night I seen Ron Paul on television. According to Ron Paul, there's nothing in the Constitution of the United States that allows the Federal Reserve System to operate the way they do. Am I correct?
That's right, yeah.
He is correct, then.
Yes. Now, there is a clause in the Constitution that gives the Congress the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof, and it's that clause that over the years has been referred to justify enormous government influence over monetary policy, including granting it to a quasi-government entity, the Federal Reserve. So it's been a stretch, but I would dare say that our founders would be horrified if they could see what we have done in the name of that clause. They never intended that to give rise to the monster that we have in Washington today.
So over the years, it's been our Congress that has let us down.
Yeah, absolutely. And by advocating their own responsibility, by creating these entities, spinning them off, and saying, here, you take care of it, then they run the show pretty much as they want to.
And truthfully, Don, was that it?
Yes, I just want to thank him for his expertise on this.
Thanks, Don. Have a great day. Let me ask you this, though. The abdication by Congress, we just saw it again with the Iraq War. I mean, is that classic behavior by Congress when they abdicate to the president in that case? The ability to make the war declaration, I mean, isn't that more of the same?
Oh, sure, yeah. I don't think we ought to be engaged in ground combat for years on end without Congress deciding whether we are formally at war or not. To allow that sort of thing to happen just as a blank check to the president to commit us anywhere and everywhere in war situations without ever declaring that it is so.
Now, a gentleman called in with a great question, and Chris, my producer, is going to relay the question because he had to let go here. What was the question, Chris?
Mr. Reed, he was asking, with our global economy, would it even be possible to put our money on gold, and wouldn't it have held us up from going to this global economy if we still had our money backed on gold?
Oh, I don't think it would hold us up at all. In fact, we would be a magnet for capital around the world. Capital looks for places where it can grow safely from political confiscation and or from inflation. And if the United States were to say the dollar is once again as good as gold, it would be a signal to the rest of the world, this is a place to put your money because it's safe and sound, and we'd be a haven. We'd be attracting capital everywhere. Now, the big question is, you know, at what ratio do you affix
right
convertibility? You could do it at a rate that would suck all of our gold out of the country or have just the opposite effect. So it has to be a market-based rate, and you also have to do other things to make it viable. You have to. Congress could not declare a return to a gold standard and continue to run $500 billion annual deficits. Nobody in the world would believe it
right
when it said, hey, we're for sound money now. They'd say, well, you're not showing it by your actions.
Deeds, not words, ever famous. There's no move towards that at all. I mean, no politician is even suggesting it.
No, that's right, and that's a sad commentary on the level of economic understanding in this country.
Well, there's no let me tell you, there's no economic understanding in this country. I mean, we have been dumbed down. You can make the argument by the public school system or whatever, but we have been dumbed down when it comes to economics so much that it makes it difficult to make a rousing argument because you feel like you're just not up to speed.
Yeah, I mean, one of the most basic questions we ought to be asking, we're not, of our politicians. We ought to be saying, okay, you've got this laundry list of new things you want the government to spend money for. Where's it going to get it when we're $500 billion in the red now, a $9 trillion national debt, and you've got presidential candidates talking about universal health care,
right.
Pre-K, just massive expansions of government at a time when it can't handle its budget. It can't even bring revenues to meet expenses or bring expenses down to meet revenues.
Well, I hope that you will come on the show again and again. I always learn so much when you come on the show, and I hope that when you're down here, you can actually come in. I would love to have you in the studio.
I'll be down there in the winter months. In the meantime, I hope people will take a look at the FEE website. That's FEE.org, F-E-E for Foundation for Economic Education.
I downloaded the law yesterday.
Oh, wonderful.
We're going to be having a Daybreak book club in the next couple of weeks. I'm going to make that required reading, and then we're going to have a discussion.
Oh, if every American read that book, we would solve 90% of our problems.
That's why I'm going to force it down the throats of my listeners. Lawrence Reed, have a fantastic day. We'll talk to you again soon, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.